on 104.3 and 104.7. KHOM Cotton, Eureka, Arcata, streaming and podcasting online at khom.com, which is made possible by the Stream Guys and translator K282AD Ferndale. And now joining me on the phone from Standing Rock, North Dakota, on behalf of Humboldt Forge, Nicola and Phil. Hi, guys.
Hi. Hi, how's it going?
Pretty good. How y'all faring out there?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Can you tell our listeners how you came to go out to Standing Rock and how long you've been there? A little backstory about why you're there?
Sure. So we came out to Standing Rock just a couple of days ago. We actually left last Sunday, I guess the 16th. We came out here with sort of the intention of supporting and being in solidarity, extending our sort of support from Humboldt Forge, from HSU, the Environment and Community Graduate Program, and the Environment and Community Club, the Journalism Department, and also the Politics Club on campus. So we had a lot of support coming with us before we left to drive out to North Dakota. And part of the support that we were able to have that really made this trip possible is we started a couple of different fundraising efforts. We started a GoFundMe, and we were able to raise $920. And we also had a travel grant awarded to us through the Environment and Community Club at HSU, and that helped provide for gas money and hotel rooms, and it was the amount of $800. So that was tremendous. And we also received supplies from Pacific Outfitters and Arcata, and we also started a t-shirt campaign. So we did a lot of different things to really get out here. So there was a lot of work that we put in before actually getting in the car and driving out to North Dakota.
And what was the trip out there like? Like, how long did it take you, and how was that trip?
Well, you know, we had been so busy before we hit the road that we actually were kind of under the weather when we hit the road. So we weren't really feeling the best, but we just took it slow. We drove to Portland, stayed overnight. Then the next day we made our way to Missoula, and then we left Missoula, and we were looking at sort of our time frame, and it looked like we were going to be arriving in North Dakota at nighttime, and we decided against that. We decided to sort of break up the trip then, so we kind of prolonged our arrival until we were able to arrive in the afternoon or in the morning time, and so we came during the day so we could really understand, you know, get a lay of the land, really connect with different people, because it can be a little bit different when you come into an unfamiliar area, especially, you know, trying to get your bearings. That's a really sort of sensitive place with a lot of different energies and sort of feelings occurring and sort of mingling here in this space. So that was sort of our judgment and made our trip sort of a good preparation, I think, as we were able to talk about how we wanted to arrive and really how we saw our participation in this area.
And how was your arrival? Were you instantly met with roadblocks, and was it easy to navigate getting there once you got to Cannonball?
Well, you know, I would say overall it was definitely pretty easy getting out here. There's one main road, Highway 1806. And so I think the most difficult thing was essentially navigating which of the camps we wanted to, you know, set foot in and start out at. And so where we ended up going was one of the main camps that's right off Highway 1806. I think they're calling it the Overflow Camp right now. It's not Sacred Stone. It's about 15 miles down the road. And they're doing a good job of, you know, regulating the in and out flow because there are a lot of families there and trying to keep people accountable. So there was definitely no hostility, but there was a short registration process. And, you know, since we're doing media out here as well, there was a small check-in. But we were instantly, you know, welcomed right as we came in the gate. They looked right at Nicola, who is a Caucasian blonde person, and said, "Welcome home."
Yeah.
Are you Native American, Phil?
I am not Native American. You know, I think I oftentimes get mistaken for it. I'm actually half Hmong and half Portuguese, and so I end up looking like a whole medley of anything from Hawaiian to like South American. And so here I definitely think there is like some idea that I might be, but.
And do you feel like that it didn't really matter that you weren't coming to Standing Rock as a member of a tribe, that you were just there in solidarity, and it sounds to me like you felt accepted immediately.
Absolutely. You know, last night there was an interesting moment that stuck out to me. There's a sacred fire that they keep burning 24/7. And so around it, there's various events going on throughout the day. And last night, there were several dances happening all night, some of which we partook in. But there was one call on the microphone where the MC yelled out, "Who's proud to be Native?" And you hear an overwhelming roar of everyone. And I do have to admit, at that moment, I did feel like a little bit of a outsider syndrome. But immediately after, someone came up and they said, "All of my Natives here, who's proud of all of our non-Natives who are here in support?" And impartiality aside, the roar was even louder than the one before. And so there's definitely a large recognition of support regardless of your nation, creed, color, religion.
Can you talk a little bit about yesterday? For people who haven't checked the news, there was probably the most arrests that we've seen in a single instant happening at a prayer that was being led on former treaty land yesterday morning. And there were 83 water protectors, I believe,
wow,
arrested.
Okay.
I'm wondering how that is affecting the camp morale. I had a really hard time sleeping last night because I was up watching the footage. There's quite a bit of video footage online of that particular confrontation between local law enforcement and the water protectors, and it was very tense and, in my opinion, a little bit strong-armed on the police end of the spectrum. They were definitely macing people and, you know, pushing them around, and they had clubs and whatnot. How is that affecting, is that affecting at all the morale there at the camps and your decisions to go out in the field, or what is that doing? Has that changed the vibe? I know you've only been there for a couple of days, but do you feel like that's changed things at all?
Well, you know, what I would say to that is this morning before the sun came up, there was a call to action, and it felt like that event in some ways had never happened. And so I would say that the resilience and determination of everyone camped out here is very strong and unbreakable in many ways. And so that is unfortunate. You know, you are actually confirming that number for us for the first time. We've been hearing 30 to 50. We heard 80 this morning. And so that is overwhelming. That sounds like about at least 40 or 50% of the people who went out there. And those types of mass arrests are definitely concerning, and they are eye-raising. But I think I'm going to pass it off to Nicola to just elaborate a little more on that.
Yeah, well, I really like how Phil acknowledged that, you know, there is that resiliency present, and that people are continuing to put themselves out there and to do whatever it takes to demonstrate their unwavering commitment to this movement. And that is, you know, seen from, you know, Native and non-Native people. And it's very powerful to be a part of, and we feel very grateful to be able to be a part. Yesterday, we did feel as though that was kind of, even yesterday, I guess even the night before, we started to feel like things were intensifying and that there was a little bit more of a call for action for people before, you know, we've heard and been able to participate in a few of the, you know, the prayers and a lot of the meetings that are discussing how things have happened up until this point. And it definitely feels like this weekend things changed. So, you know, we definitely got onto social media following the event and following the arrest as all of our, you know, fellow protectors are coming back, you know, from that confrontation with law enforcement, and we're doing our best to really let people know the severity of really where the situation is going and sort of the magnitude of which people are being cracked down on by law enforcement. It definitely seems as though law enforcement in the past, you know, has been veering away from sort of standard protocol for dealing with protectors, and it looks like they're continuing to use tactics, techniques that would not, as you were mentioning, you know, it's surprising to many of us. It's surprising to us here. People that we've been talking to are even reiterating from, you know, being based here in this community that they never thought that this type of the corporation would be using this style of involvement with protectors as they have been.
Yeah, and just a small note on that. Yesterday, when people came back from the front lines, what they were saying was that law enforcement was specifically targeting media. Mm-hmm. Media here is designated. You have a red badge, and it's so everyone knows who you are. And they're specifically targeting media. In one of the videos, you can see there's a journalist who walks up in front of everyone before the line of law enforcement runs out. And I believe she was tackled to the ground, had her stuff confiscated. And anyone else with a camera is specifically being signaled out. And not only that, but communication for people that are involved is also being disrupted. There are multiple reports of live feeds being fine until law enforcement arrives, and there's definitely disruption happening with communication. And so it is kind of troubling because it's hard to keep this in the public light when you have people like Amy Goodman being charged with trespassing, when we see the language changing from trespass to riot. And it's really, I think, sending a message to journalists to stay away, to not cover this, and if you do, there will be consequences to reap. And so it's definitely interesting, the extremities of the tactics that they're reaching for right now.
And speaking of journalists, I got to speak last week with Myron Dewey. He is the head of digital smoke signals, and he's been keeping people updated via his social media site as well. And I've been trying to get a gauge of what's going on. And the same day that Amy Goodman went in and her charges were dropped, Myron was speaking with me about how he was trying to document the private hired mercenaries by the Dakota Access Pipeline Company. And apparently, since I had spoken with him, there was a warrant issued for his arrest on charges of stalking. It was a misdemeanor charge, and he did turn himself in, and he was booked and released. But he and many other people who are being booked and released are reporting that they were strip searched.
Right.
When they were in the custody of the Morton County Sheriff's Office, and he also mentioned that, you know, he didn't take any of his medicine or anything in with him, and that that is proving to be a bit of a challenge for people who do require medical attention while they are in police custody.
Yeah, I think you're really bringing up some really significant, you know, red flags here, because this exactly falls into alignment with the diversity of tactics being used by law enforcement specifically that is not within the normal bounds of addressing protectors, of addressing any kind of movement of this nature. You know, when people are dealing with that type of treatment, and we've even heard, you know, folks being held overnight, you know, strip searched and denied their clothing, held overnight. These types of tactics are being allowed by law enforcement, and what folks were running into was, you know, law enforcement from a lot of different agencies, and so there's really nothing that's holding Energy Access accountable for this type of, you know, for their law enforcement, you know, that they're privately contracting, or even for the law enforcement that is here based locally. And I know that, you know, we're not trying to demonize, like, the law enforcement individuals, because, you know, even here at the camp, there is a lot of acknowledgement that I thought was especially moving, where they're asking for prayers for law enforcement, because here we have a community that is unified and standing strong together, and we have law enforcement that are estranged from their community. They may be with their coworkers out here, but, you know, they really don't have that same kind of energy and force behind them that we all have. And so we've had, you know, members of the Lakota calling for, you know, just prayers across the board for them as well, even though they're being met with this type of hostility by the law enforcement, because they recognize that law enforcement is just trying to do their jobs here. But I definitely think that on a national level, statewide level, you know, on a national level, we need to be really questioning the ways that corporations are utilizing law enforcement and are able to engage in these types of practices, because, you know, this is definitely, in our minds, unprecedented in something of this nature.
So speaking of kind of following up on that sentiment, and I did see some footage of, you know, people who were protectors engaging with the law enforcement and telling them that they don't blame them, that, you know, they're praying for them, and they realize that their beef is not with the local law enforcement, it's with the Dakota Access Pipeline Company.
Right.
And that was really powerful to watch that. Do you feel safe?
No.
Well, definitely not.
I think Bill wants to speak about that a little bit more.
Really, it's sleep with one eye open is the current status of things. You know, it was funny the other night, I heard a goose honking, and I was just kind of like, why is that goose honking? And, you know, I thought that all these books about Vietnam and whatnot, where when geese make noise at night, something is wrong. And that's usually like, you know, it just kind of got me worried. But really, it is worrisome, because what we're seeing is the increasing intensity of law enforcement and the extremes to which they're willing to go to. What we have to understand is that Energy Access is a multi-billion dollar company that does not hold interests that necessarily align with the people of the public. And so we're seeing arrests go increasingly higher. 80 people getting arrested is insane. We're hearing accounts of bail for things simple, like simple as trespassing, go from hundreds of dollars to thousands of dollars. The jails are getting full. That means they're going further away. And the kind of intimidation that's happening is on multiple levels. Not only is it physical in the sense that people are being arrested and detained and harassed, but it's also psychological. There's aerial harassment happening almost all day with planes and helicopters. And then beyond that, on the spiritual level as well, we've seen Energy Access, when they dozed over the sacred sites, that was a big middle finger to not only the judicial system and our administrative process, but to the tribes here, because that's essentially saying, F your heritage, let's disturb your ancestors, and we will free them in this world, because we don't give a damn, and we will get what we want. So when we're dealing with a company like that, no, Nicola and I, we do not feel safe. If there's anything that makes us feel safe, it's the protection that the tribes are offering around us. Their security on horseback, and like I've been saying, the in and out flow is heavily monitored. But I don't think it's out of the question were there to be some kind of massive sweep happening. Not to sound conspiratorial, but I don't hold it out of the question.
Okay, I appreciate you guys being out there, and I appreciate you joining me on the phone. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Phil and Nicola, and they are at Standing Rock, North Dakota right now on behalf of Humboldt Forge. And moving forward, how can members, local members of our community, listeners, from your perspective, what is the next step, and how can people assist in these efforts who are moved to help the people who are there protecting the water?
Yeah. You know, we've been thinking about that quite a bit, and I think that right now, if anyone has the ability to get to North Dakota, the demand for people to stand out here and to show their solidarity is the most pressing thing. You know, folks are needed. Bodies, people are needed. It's less about supplying propane and socks, you know. It's more about, can you get to North Dakota? Can you come out here and actually stand against this corporation who is, you know, that is using whatever means necessary to continue this project. But we also have been thinking a lot about how it's so critically important that we change the narrative about how we're addressing this issue and how we're talking about even Indigenous peoples who are putting themselves out here and, you know, really taking a stand not only for the, you know, security of their water resources, but also of their cultural history and their futures. And so the demonization in the media trying to paint this movement as being disorganized, as being riotous, as, you know, a bunch of felons and career activists who are, you know, drug addicts and alcoholics. I mean, this type of language is used to divide and justify annihilation of people. And we need to really recognize that colonialistic rhetoric that's being used in the media to perpetuate these types of harms against people and against the land. So I think that's really critically important. But also, you know, if people are looking for ways that they can, you know, help with supplies, you know, it's going to be a cold winter and people are looking at permanent winterization projects so that they can build structures that will be lasting through the winter and will help to support the community that will stand here until this pipeline is stopped. And I mean that very seriously, that this is not a negotiable issue, and that the community is standing strong in their resolve that this pipeline will not cross the road, it will not cross the river. And so to recognize the urgency of this, and especially the time-sensitive nature of this, is, I think, very critical for us to understand. You know, this has been happening since April. People have been out here for months. But in the last couple of days, we definitely have seen an intensification of the energies here, and we need to understand that burial sites are being destroyed, that this is a history, you know, this is that these are landmarks, that these are identities that cannot be resolved if they're, you know, they cannot be restored once they've been taken, you know? And so that's, I think, really critical for us to get that message out there. And I also think it's really important for people when they're looking at this issue from afar to recognize, even though there's solidarity of non-Native and Native people on this issue, the direction comes from the Lakota, and the solidarity with Indigenous peoples has to be at the forefront of this, that the direction doesn't come necessarily from our own agendas as people who are trying to get messages out about what's happening and trying to paint a picture of really how the movement is taking place. I think that it's really critically important that we are sort of looking within our own instincts, you know, checking within ourselves to really see what kind of agenda is behind every piece of information that's coming out of here. Because even, you know, in the camp, you know, we always have to be checking ourselves and checking each other to acknowledge, to respect, and to prioritize the wishes and the interests of the community that is local here. And that's why we're camping close to the sacred fire that has been, you know, that has brought together, you know, diverse communities for the first time in
the first formation of the seven councils since like around the 1800s.
Mm-hmm. And so really our direction needs to be what is within the, you know, the interests of the people who are here, who live here, who don't get to just check in as a supporter, as valuable as the supporters are, and then just get to go back to their community. You know, all of our involvement has a lasting impact, and we have to recognize that we're here as support, as like secondary support to a movement that's being directed by a local community and in alignment with the wishes of the local community. So it's a lot. It's not just one thing, but there are a lot of different ways that we need to consider, you know, this movement, consider how it isn't something that should just be looked at as, oh, it's, you know, this is a environmental movement with a whole bunch of the same old people coming together doing environmental activist things. This is a very different kind of of engagement with environmental issues, with cultural issues, and it has to challenge us to confront our own participation. And to, you know, I'm getting a little bit long-winded, but I feel very passionately about this, and I think that this is really the motivation for Phil and I to come out here, is that the Humboldt Forge in Humboldt County, you know, is a community advocacy group. What we are doing here is trying to bridge that connection between Northern California and North Dakota to show individuals, to help us to interact with the concepts here, that this is our backyard, that the ways that we interact with indigenous people, the ways that we interact with our natural resources, the ways that we engage between community and corporate relationships is so fundamental to Northern California. And so we have to recognize that we are tied to this issue, and that the way that things become resolved, or however they go down here in North Dakota, is going to have a dramatic impact on the continuation of the story of corporate domination of community interests or environmental interests or indigenous peoples and the cultural practices that are so fundamental to our community as well. And I think that's just so important that we acknowledge that moving forward and continue to challenge ourselves to go beyond really the stories that we've continued or that we've participated in up until this point.
Well, I wanted to thank you again, Nicola and Phil, for being there and for sharing your perspective. For listeners who want to follow up or continue to hear some more from you or connect with you, what is the best way for them to be put in touch with the Humboldt Forge?
We do have a website. It's humboldtforge.org. We will be doing daily updates on our website there. We also have links on our website for our Facebook group. The Humboldt Forge Facebook group is also a place where people can stay up to date on community issues and how we're interacting and bridging the Standing Rock movement to Northern California and continuing the conversation once we do return home. So I think that this is something that is not isolated to just, you know, our participation out here, but we hope that people continue to, you know, engage with the community advocacies that, you know, we're looking to promote in Humboldt County as well.
Well, thank you again for being out there, and thank you for taking some time out of your day. I know it was a challenge to find a good place to be able to have a phone call without any kind of interference and whatnot. So thanks for putting forth that effort. And I will be putting this interview, if you're just joining us and you weren't able to listen to the whole discussion, I'm going to be putting it up at khum.com here very shortly. And I will also send it to you guys if you wanted to include it in any of the stuff that you're doing on the Humboldt Forge site. So,
Lindsay, well, before we go, you know, I just wanted to say a quick thanks to the entire community of Humboldt and all of our friends at large, because, well, you know, I'm sure it's great that we're out here for you all. It wouldn't be possible without our community support behind us. And so I just wanted to take a quick second to acknowledge that.
Awesome. Well, thank you for being out there and representing Humboldt and for checking in with us. And I hope that we can stay in touch and stay safe out there, you guys, okay?
Okay,
thank you. Okay. All right. We were just talking to Phil and Nicola from Humboldt Forge, and they are out in Standing Rock, North Dakota right now. Things are getting quite tense. There was an arrest made yesterday, mass arrest of 83 of the water protectors, and a particular site is on treaty land. And I will be uploading this conversation fairly shortly to khum.com. But we're going to take a break for right now. And when we come back, we'll have some more music for you here on KHUM. So stick around.